Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Bring yourself back online.
No one knows what I'm thinking.
Tell us what you think of your world.
This is just a cheap trick.
Some people choose to see the ugliness in this world. The disarray. I choose to see the beauty.
Welcome to Still Watching Westworld, an unofficial podcast about the HBO series Westworld. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Each week, we'll break down the latest theories, baffling questions, and hidden allusions, as well as occasionally chat with someone who has worked on the show itself. This week, we have two interviews. We've got Katya Herbers, who plays Emily, and Angela Serafian, who plays Clementine. So two lovely ladies joining us this week. But before we get to them, we are going to be discussing and spoiling only up to season 2, episode 9, Vanishing Point, directed by Stephen Williams and written by Robert Pattino. And Richard, I mean, I know you and I were both really enthusiastic about last week's episode. Did you have any overall thoughts about your enjoyment level on this one? Was it a huge come down? Did you like it fine? How did you feel?
I mean, we'll get into it, but I'm glad that Celia Ward is now the lead of the show. She's going to come back every episode, right?
Right.
My beloved Celia Ward from Once and Again and various other things.
Sisters.
Sisters. And she's briefly the president in Independence Day Resurgence. She was killed by one-armed man in The Fugitive.
She sure was.
I mean, she's been, she's great.
Spoiler for The Future.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. I did like the episode, and again, we'll get to it. Something so horrible happens at one point that it just kind of bummed me out for the rest of the time. And I don't want to say what that is. But I think you can guess. But anyway.
Yeah. I too was no. All right. Before we get into our sort of beat by beat breakdown of the episode, and we're going to take this episode sort of storyline by storyline as we do sometimes just to keep everything straight and coherent. Before we get to that, I wanted to get to a couple emails. We got one email from Jody Taylor, and I'm just going to read it because of the very charming way in which she writes. But she says, "Hey, just wanted to say I love the show and send a couple random thoughts after listening to last week's episode. Bullet point number one. Legitimately had the same thought as Richard during Ed Harris's Billiam crawling to the river acting. I made the mistake of texting my mother about this, and she, weirdly passionate in her response, told me to get on that tweets and remind you guys he was pee chill in The Right Stuff." So we got a lot of tweets from people telling us movies that Ed Harris was a nice guy in.
You know what we did not get, though?
What?
Any resounding endorsements of Milk Money. Come on, guys. Way to fall down on a prompt. We told you to tell us Milk Money.
Yeah, you guys, I presume you guys all rushed out and watched it last week, so we're still waiting for our report back on Milk Money.
Yeah.
We got some stepmom tweets and a lot of The Right Stuff tweets, so apparently you guys have a thing for astronauts, and that's fine. And then she also writes, I wonder if anyone working on Westworld is mad that the Altered Carbon Netflix show came out before season two. A lot of the cupcake consciousness theory stuff reminds me of Stacks from Altered Carbon. Am I alone in that thought? Maybe a recommendation to anyone that likes these philosophical ideas in Westworld. And I haven't watched Altered Carbon. Did you watch it, Richard?
I don't know what that is, and I refuse to find out what it is. No, no, I'm kidding. I know what it is, but I will never watch it. Sorry.
Right. So this is a sci-fi Netflix series that came out earlier this year. Neither of us watched it, and I heard mixed things about it. Mixed, kind of negative, actually. But I have heard from a lot of people that a lot of the themes that are covered in Altered Carbon, which has to do, it's a sort of Ghost in the Shell-esque thing about putting your consciousness in new bodies. That it relates to this. So Altered Carbon watchers, you are not alone. A lot of people feel this way, but Richard and I still will not watch this, at least until all of you watch Milk Money. So
that's the ultimatum. Yeah.
And those are just some of Jody's bullet points, but that's a good start. And then we got an email from Shelby, one of many people writing into us to let me know that I got a line wrong in last week's episode where Akichita is talking to Ford in that like striking frozen tableau scene. And he says, I think he says, I gave myself a new tribe. Apparently he said I gave myself a new drive. So here I was like, oh, it's so beautiful. Everyone's in his tribe now. Mm-hmm. But people who watched with closed captioning on told me that it's drive. So he gave himself a new mission, which was to spread consciousness around the park, basically. It's not a completely dissimilar sentiment, but maybe not quite as sort of religiously and spiritually impactful as what I thought the line was.
And maybe a little bit more anachronistic in terms of the language use.
Sure. Yeah. He's using some robot language there, but, so there you go. That's some feedback. Thank you guys so much for all of that feedback. So like I said, we are going to break down this episode sort of storyline by storyline. We are going to save, Ed Harris, William for last, because this is kind of a really big Ed Harris episode, Mr. Milk Money himself. So we are going to start instead with our girl Maeve, who spends the entire episode incapacitated on a gurney. And something that I realized in this episode is that Maeve, Tandy Newton, you know, I consider her after Seal Award, the star of the show. And, but she's done a lot of silent listening. Cause I remember in the Shogun episode, she's gagged for part of that episode. She has to do a lot of listening. She basically just listened all last week. That's all she did. And again, once again, this week, she's just listening, but she does a really good job. She's like very attentive, active, immobilized listener.
Yeah. It's good eye acting, like kind of, you know, sort of what, you know, searching sort of, you know, like we get the sense that like consciousness is like roiling in her again, you know?
Yeah. So, we'll start like just before Maeve, we'll start instead with Clementine. We see that Charlotte, you know, Bernard is sort of creeping, lurking in the shadows as Charlotte and this, Delos guy who we definitely don't like because he's got a creepy beard and a bad attitude. It has sort of transferred Maeve's god powers to the Clementine character. And we see, her use these powers to basically incite all the hosts around through the mesh network, incite all the hosts around her to violence, and they all kill each other. And so what it seems to be the plan is that Charlotte is going to use Clementine to destroy all the hosts in the park, like use those powers to make Clementine go make everyone kill each other. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, they're making a new sort of less pure god, right?
Right.
You know, Maeve was sort of, well, I mean, she's born of Ford's intent, but like, you know, it's a more sort of organic and, you know, thing. They're like, okay, we can use this little bit of coding that like makes her magic and use it against them. So, you know, classic like technology in the wrong hands, sort of, you know, like how can we weaponize it? How, you know, et cetera.
This feels like a good place to take pause and talk to Angela Serafian about Clementine's crazy new powers. Angela, thank you so much for joining us on this podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'm so honored to be here. I love your podcast.
We should explain to listeners that this is the second time we've done this interview. We are back on our loop together again. We tried this a couple weeks ago. There was a technical glitch. I'm going to blame Anthony Hopkins. I'd say Ford deleted the interview that we did a couple weeks ago. So
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Here we go again.
It's never happened before because no one's heard it.
Exactly. So. Just, only you and I know what happened in that conversation. So we are going to go again, but so much has happened to Clementine since you and I talked. She has operated a machine gun and she has majorly leveled up in power. So before we talk about the crazy stuff you do in episode 9, let's just hop back a little bit to episode 7, where you get to do this major shootout in the Mesa and everything that happens there. What was that like to shoot? How did you enjoy being like Clementine, the action hero? Like, what was that like for you?
I love all those action related stuff because it's kind of like dancing. You choreograph the whole thing so no one actually gets hurt. But it's really fun. It's like an adrenaline rush. And I'd never used a machine gun before. You can imagine.
Really?
So
wow.
So there it was in the flash kind of. It was crazy to use that thing. It was really, really powerful. You can't even imagine what that could do. So I had no idea how it would turn out. And I think it was okay, right?
Oh, it looked great. I think the contrast of your great sort of zombie Clementine look and then coupled with that crazy future gun is a pretty good look, I think.
Yeah, and it's like the only time that you see Clementine this season get violent. You know, prior to that, there isn't anything she's doing that's deliberately or just hurting another person or being without purpose. Everything has its reason. So I like that there was a reason why she was doing that.
Right.
Which is to protect the possible future of having that freedom that she obviously doesn't have.
Right. And then we get a little bit more of a different kind of violence in this week's episode, obviously, when it seems to me like some of Maeve's coding has been transplanted over or copied over into Clementine. So now you have the badass Tandy Newton godlike powers as well.
I know, isn't that crazy that she and I were in the Mariposa and now we're like almost on the ends of two spectrums doing the exact same thing. Only Clementine is there for destruction, as you could see in episode 9.
Yeah.
Like she has it's awful.
Putting her in that, back in that sort of glass fronted exam room, you know, obviously like it's a reference back to season 1 when they sort of tried to use Clementine to demonstrate a faked glitch in the code and they make her do something super violent back in season 1. I'm wondering what it is about Clementine that, you know, she's Charlotte Hale's favorite lab rat. Like what is it about you that puts you in that position?
I think her innocence initially is the wonderful candidate because you're like, there's a person who sees only love in the world and doesn't, even though she's lived a lifetime full of awful things and deaths and things like that, she doesn't remember them. So with her, I guess, design, it's easy to manipulate, at least at this point with Clementine. So, and it's sad because it continues on up until this point. You know, she's always under the control of somebody. I mean, I my feeling is maybe it is Dr. Ford that's telling her to drag Bernard to Elsie. So she doesn't have a mind of her own. And I think that Charlotte Hale sees that as an opportunity, especially after they kill her. You know, she's dead now. So why not use this vessel for more destruction?
When they kill her, and then bring her back. Like, is she still, how much is she still Clementine in that scene? Or how much is she a shell?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at what's happening with Maeve, I feel like there is a similar, obviously very different places they're both at, but there's a similar level of existence of, okay, this is still that post. This is still that being. So I don't think she isn't Clementine. I think she is. It's just that she is the perfect example of the destruction of a host. Like what really happens, like when a host completely deteriorates. And so when Clementine in this season now has the ability to just simply by her presence destroy all these hosts.
Yeah.
It's incredibly heartbreaking. It's just, there was this great line that Akechita said, he said, for every, and this is obviously not, I'm not quoting him, but it was this idea that with every host down in, when they're all dead, every host down here has a mourner. So I thought, they're so human. These hosts are so human. And they're more human than us, especially the examples in the show. So, you know, that is unfortunately now going to be destroyed by simply Clementine's existence.
When you do this sort of beautiful, almost serene movements where you're sort of holding your hand up to the glass and causing all this destruction around you, or when Clementine does this, when you go into sort of godlike Zen mode, did you look to anything that Tandy had done in her performance to sort of guide what you did?
Actually, I didn't. So in that moment when Clementine touches the glass and all the other hosts on the other side of the glass start to destroy each other, kill each other, I thought the more delicate the touch, the more effortless it is, and kind of, you know, very, very subtle, the more powerful it is. Yeah. Because it doesn't take much, you know. I think it's scarier if you're not using any kind of effort at all, and you can do something so powerful in a way. So that's all I thought about in that moment. But regarding Tandy's performance in season two, where I think she begins to have these abilities, I think we see that mostly in episode five. That's when it all kind of changes. I wasn't privy to seeing any of that. So my approach was simply kind of more through movement. And I don't know. I always think that Clementine is in a different place when she's asleep. Mm. I never see her as someone as asleep. So it's like we sleep and we dream. And I think she must be in a dream state as well. Just a different reality.
Mm. So sad. When last we spoke, which was lost to time, we were talking about how interesting it was for you this season to have the Clementine character sort of refracted across three different versions, or two different versions in addition to yourself, because there was the Sakura character over in Shogun World.
Oh, yeah.
Then there's the character that Lily Simmons plays over in the Mariposa. Then there's, you know, sleeping Clementine. And then since then we got Cradle Clementine, right? And so I was just wondering if you could talk about like the idea, and your character is not the only one to have that happen, but maybe the only one to have four different sort of versions in one season. What it's like to have Clementine reflected and refracted against all those different characters.
Well, you know, I as the season began in episode two, I'm OG Clementine, like super old. Like, so she's one of the oldest hosts in the park, because when you see her playing the piano, those are the originals. So it was really kind of cool to play that very beginning Clementine kind of as a functioning guest at a party who also is a pianist. That came naturally to me because I play the piano myself. And so when Jonas brought that up about, would you learn the man I love by Gershwin? And I thought, yes, I can't wait. I'm going to get to play Gershwin on Westworld. So, that was fun to do. Then you see her as zombie Clementine. And I thought, you know, what's interesting about playing that part of her was she's no longer functioning on a character. No one's given her this loop that she has to live every day. And I still believe she's Clementine. It's just that now she's just like with no, I guess, she just simply is in her soul, in her essence, this one thing. And she no longer is trapped in somebody else's kind of created world. Even though she's still being controlled by Dr. Ford, she's not taking imaginary actions. They're real things that she's doing this season. So they're actual steps into going into freedom, I think. So with that, I thought I used ballet a little bit and some characters like there's a beautiful ballerina named Maya Plisetskaya. So she was an inspiration in some of the characters that she created in terms of Clementine's strength for this season. And then the last Clementine, well, we'll just like do three. I love going back into the Mariposa and playing her, you know, actually her and her loop, but it's simulation, so it was in the cradle.
One hilarious thing I think that happened is, you know, when last we spoke, we talked a little bit about you being part of that Rickroll video because of your piano playing skills. So this like video that Jonah and Lisa Joy put up to on Reddit before the season started, they roped you in to sort of play the piano. But what was hilarious is then when there was the huge reveal of the season, which is the episode 6, oh my God, Anthony Hopkins is back. There was a dog and a piano, and I'm like, oh my God, there was truth in that video.
Yes, there are clues everywhere. There are clues. You just have to really look and dissect every little thing. It's like a big puzzle.
Okay, so you know what's happening in the finale, but you cannot tell me anything because then you will be decommissioned and sent back to cold storage. Is that right?
That's true.
Yeah. I guess my last question is then, you know, having been part of season one and season two, both of which deal with so much mystery that's so fun for some people and then like so maddening and frustrating for other people. Have you seen any, in terms of fan reaction or, you know, questions you get shouted at you on the street or anything like that, have you seen any difference in terms of, I don't know, the way that people are thinking about solving the mysteries? Are people this season just more willing to let it kind of wash over them, or are people sort of like even more invested in trying to figure out what's going on at any given moment?
I feel like they're even more invested only because there's so many elements in the story that they're trying to puzzle together. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I see kind of just, and people really love the show. I was just recently in New York and I was amazed to see how much, you know, it affects people. And it's kind of awesome. You know, you walk through a park and someone might recognize me and then we might get into an entire conversation about what's happened up until that point. And I love that. I love that people are very affected by the show.
Well, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you. I had a good time.
I'm sorry for everyone who didn't get to hear the first conversation, but this
I was, know, it was so much better, you guys.
It was way better. No.
It really was. It was so much, and it's gone forever.
It's gone forever. Yeah, this is great. And I cannot, I mean, having seen, you know, we saw Machine Gun Clementine, we saw, you know, Ethereal Behind a Glass, destroying everyone, Clementine. I cannot wait to see what craziness you get to do in the finale. So I'm excited.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, me too. I can't wait to see it. I haven't seen it either. So I'll be watching with everyone. And thank you, Joanna. This was really fun.
And then it also, you know, in this scene, Angela as Clementine, I think, does some great, like, I don't know, ethereal hand to the glass acting.
Yeah.
And it feels like a callback to season one when they used Clementine again in a different test, when they were like sort of faking a glitch in the code and they made her like kill another host in that same like exam room.
Yeah.
So basically they keep using Clementine as their guinea pig. So we'll see what
they really, really like to use her for some reason.
I mean, this, those eyes, those yeah. big old eyes, yeah. you know? So Bernard sees this and he freaks out and he wants to like run out to the park and go to the rescue. But Ford is like, no, wait, first, we got one more stop to make.
Yeah. Cause Bernard is like furious that like they would rather destroy everything.
Right.
Than like, yeah. Than lose out or no, whatever, you know?
Right. And so Bernard goes to find Maeve on Ford's instruction and, Ford, like basically Ford communes with her. And through the mesh network, once again, the you know, hard porting and mesh networking and terraforming are our favorite things to explain away everything at Westworld. But basically Ford.
Well, also because yeah. like there's a part where Bernard like tries to gain access to the room and they're like denied. And Ford's yeah. like, oh, don't worry, close enough. And it's like, okay, yeah. so wait. So now it's a proximity thing? I thought this network was like sort of park wide. Like they can only communicate when there's someone nearby. You know, like,
it's supposed I think when Bernard first explained it, it's supposed to be a proximity thing.
Okay.
Like, but way back at the beginning of the season, he was like, hosts can commune with the hosts near them through the mesh network. And that's why they're taking like Clementine, I guess, out into the park. It has to do with proximity. But the question is, how was it Akichita was able to commune with Maeve in last week's episode?
Well, yeah.
I mean, they're both gods, basically. So
maybe they yada, transcend yada, yada.
And using Anna, her daughter, as kind of a portal. I don't know.
But there's, for the most part, it's like Apple Watch thing where you're like, oh, cool, a watch that can, you know, do computers. And then it's like, well, no, you have to be near Wi-Fi or your phone.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Oh, and something that a listener pointed out to me last week that I didn't realize, if you guys are going to go rewatch, Kikusuya, the episode last week, when Akichita is talking to, like, telling his story, when he's talking to Anna, Maeve's daughter, he uses English. And then when he's talking to Maeve, he uses Lakota. And so the dialogue is split between those two characters, which right. I think is kind of fun and interesting and not something I picked up on my own. But anyway, so Bernard leaves and we'll get back to him, but you know, Ford stays behind and he is now sort of hopped a ride in Maeve's consciousness. You know, people are having fun coming up with portmanteau names for what, you know, what Bernard is with a Ford inside of him and all that sort of stuff. But I'm really excited that now we can call the Ford and Maeve combination Fave, right?
Yes. Like, yeah, I mean, there's no other. I mean,
our problematic Fave or something like that. So, you know, a Ford. And this is like a beautiful couple of scenes between Anthony Hopkins and Tandy Newton, two characters that we have not seen interact that much. But they, you know, he is basically monologuing to her. And, you know, basically the Delos guy we don't like says, it's not long for you, sweetheart, meaning like they're going to decommission Maeve as soon as they figure out that the code is like for sure working in Clementine. And then Anthony Hopkins starts, yeah, like monologuing to her. And, this is some of what we were talking about 2 weeks ago, where like Anthony Hopkins could literally say anything and we're like
yeah.
totally here for it. He starts dropping classical quotes, but he also like, he, you know, I think one of the criticisms of Anthony Hopkins in season one was that he could just like, he was a little bit phoning it in and it doesn't really matter when it's Anthony Hopkins. He could like passively read the phone book and we'd be interested. But like Anthony Hopkins showed up to work today when he did this scene because he is like crying over Maeve. And I found it actually kind of affecting. What did you think of their interaction?
I thought it was good. I still wish that I had a better understanding of why Maeve was his favorite, you know, of all the hosts and all, you know, everything, like what particularly about her, because I don't feel like that was clarified unless I missed something. But I still did really like the scene. And going back to the tech being like, you know, not long for you, toots, or whatever, like,
yeah.
something about the show, it's like, why are they all so mean? I mean, these people spend so much time tending to these, you know, machines or, you know, hosts or whatever, caring for them, fixing them, learning from them. And so many of them are like sadistic to them. And I guess that's maybe like a commentary on like humanity or something. But I was like, would I be that horrible to them if I were around them? I don't know. It's just like, it's a little detail of the show that I mean, obviously there are some texts that are nice, but like on the whole, I don't know if that's like a hiring practice or what.
Yeah. I don't know if it's supposed to be like, this is why we understand the Sizemore thing of like, his transformation that happened once he went into the park and saw
right.
them as more than just, you know, like computers tool, with meat slabs on them. But something that Ford says to Maeve is he says that like he felt so cynical about the world, basically, that the only way for him to process it was to laugh at it. And that's kind of who the Maeve character was when we met her in the saloon.
Right.
Like, basically, that he made that character in his image. I don't think you can really apply that necessarily to the Homestead version of Maeve. Like, my interpretation of her is that she wasn't exactly, like, wisecracking out on the prairie, but maybe she was. My favorite Laura Ingalls Wilder book, by the way, Wisecrack on the Prairie.
Oh, when she does stand-up? Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God, that's a great one. Yeah, they turned that into an FX series, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
FXX, sorry, yeah.
But I think that's sort of their, like, a feeble excuse for like why she's his favorite, because he maybe made her in his image, that version of Maeve.
Yeah.
But you know, he and then he reveals that it was his intention for her to escape. Like, this is kind of a big question of like, was Maeve programmed to escape the park, or was she, you know, supposed to come back? He wanted her to leave. And then he says this thing about like, you came back to save your child, and that's what I did too. And so like, yeah, you're right. It's a little bit of like an out of left field that Maeve is definitely Ford's favorite, though. Like, she did seem blessed with some faculties last season that no one else has. So you can sort of see. And then they have this.
I mean, she's our favorite. So, you know, it stands to reason that, you know, Anthony Hopkins, or excuse me, Ford, is only human.
Yeah. But, and then there's this beautiful moment where he gives her this kiss. And then you see her code updating.
Well, he does this funny thing in this kind of long monologue where he's like, you know, regarding her prone on the thing, where it's like a little bit like Ryan Seacrest in American Idol at the eliminations, where he's like, you're out of a winning competition because you're losing because you're in. And, you know, it's like this like circular thing. And you're like, wait, Ryan, are they going home or not? You know, are they safe or not? And with this, I was like, wait, Ford, are you going to let her die or not? And he kept being like, but you're going to die, but maybe you won't. And, you know, so finally he's like, no, I want you to live. You know,
yeah.
But I like that it took a while, but it was also like a little bit like, come on, just cut to the chase.
Yeah, you're right. He goes like, you've come so far and so much of your story left to tell. Shame to let them end it here.
It's like, well, okay, so
don't let them. Yeah, fair. Yeah. So he kisses her, and then on the tablet you see it says unlocking core permissions. So like, whatever badass godlike stuff Maeve could do before, apparently now she can do more. I don't know what it's gonna be, but
it's gonna be the stand-up comedy.
I hope she does stand-up comedy and literally breathes fire, those two things together.
You know what she's gonna do? She's gonna finish the final two Game of Thrones books.
Oh my god. With a winter and a dream of spring.
Yeah,
I can't wait. Yep. All right, so let's hop over to Bernard, one of Ford's other faves, apparently. And this is a great, you know, not much happens for Bernard. Basically, like, he leaves the Mesa with Elsie. They get in the dune buggy. They only make it so far. And then he abandons Elsie.
Yeah, poor.
And Shannon Woodward's crying on the side of the
road.
She's been like
double fucked by him now. Like end of towards the first season, like, you know, he locks her in a cave or whatever. And now he just like abandons her. It's really a really fraught relationship. But what this plot line did, this episode, is something I was very grateful for, which is, I don't know about you, but I get very tired very quickly of like, there's someone in my head, get out of my head, you know, kind of things where people are hallucinating or whatever.
Yeah.
That gets so repetitive and so interior, like, that I'm glad that this episode, I think, was just like, okay, we're done with that now.
Yeah. And like this moment, for Jeffrey Wright's delivery of like, get the fuck out of my head, was it was an energy we haven't seen from him.
Yeah. No, he's been so like not on one register, but you know, like calm almost.
Yeah. Like subdued, confused, blah, blah. So this anger and, you know, I interviewed Jeffrey Wright for this podcast 2 weeks ago, but like, we couldn't talk about this episode, but I had already seen this episode. And so then I told him, I was like, I freaked the fuck out when he said that line. And he was like, it's been a long ass time coming for Bernard. I was like, yeah. So, you know, basically Bernard boots Ford out of his head, and abandons, Elsie. The thing to note, I guess, here is when he does that, you know, he just reminds us where the hard port goes by cutting into his arm. We will see a similar gesture, elsewhere in the episode, but that's, I think, why that happens, like, not just so that he could literally delete Ford out of his programming, but so that we could get that hard porting reminder. And we get the revelation of like what the Valley Beyond is called. It's got a name. It's called the Forge. And I'm sorry, Lisa Joy and Jonah Nolan. You can't name it the Forge. It's too close to Ford. I don't like it. Like
Ford's Forge.
Ford's Forge. The Valley Forge.
Yeah.
I don't know. When they said that, this is one of two moments in this episode where I was like, I want to run this through the writer's room one more time.
Are you telling me you don't want to hear Anthony Hopkins say, "May the Forge be with you"? I mean, come on.
Okay, I take it all back. Yep. You're right. I do want that. There's this, comparing what Ford is doing to Bernard here to what he does with Maeve, because it goes right from that scene where he's so tender and nice with Maeve to like where he's like haunting Bernard in the way that you hate. And he's very.
And telling him to kill somebody, a human.
Yeah. Telling him to kill someone, telling him, you're the only one who can stop all of it, blah, blah, blah. And so it feels to me like very angel devil, right? He's an angel for Maeve and a devil for Bernard. And that's been part of this sort of like maddening inconsistency with Ford's character where you're like, hero or villain? I can't tell.
Well, except that I think that what has happened with him is that he has, or whatever version of him this is like, he is fully in the tank for the host and does not care about people anymore. And so whatever he can do to sort of advance that cause, be it killing people or whatever, like that's his agenda. And, you know, I think he's completely like humans to him are the host to other people.
Right. And so then it reminds me of that Jim Delos quote about like, you know, we were told there were two fathers, one above and one below, but it's the same. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like if you've got like Ford is this sort of angel demon figure in this episode, it's like, no, it's just the same. And it's a demon.
Yeah.
And it's and like he's right and he's wrong. I don't know. Like we like Elsie. Like if he wants to pick on a number of other humans, we wouldn't mind. Like if he's like, go ahead, kill Charlotte, I'd kind of be like, okay,
yeah.
She can go. But Elsie, like, she just wanted to go to dental school. We like Elsie. So, you know, it's Ford's a slippery one. But we'll see. I mean, so he seemed to kind of
if he did kill Elsie, she'd be the happiest corpse you'd ever seen, though.
I don't know if this is if we're going to see Ford in the finale, to be honest with you, because like he leaves Bernard here and it seems to me like he kind of leaves Maeve.
Well, yeah, he sends her off on her way.
Yeah.
He gives her his final gift or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's
kisses
it.
Her and that's it.
And so, also because what we're seeing of Ford talking to Maeve is sort of kind of what he communicated to her through Bernard, right? We're just seeing it sort of manifest in a different time. Is that at all?
It seems to me like he hopped code. He hopped okay. from, like, he spread out into her code and just,
right.
Yeah. Or it's just like, yeah, the personification of him unlocking some code for her. But,
he's transcendence. He's Johnny Depp.
It's true. But the rules are out the window. I don't mind if it means more Anthony Hopkins. But, it's possible he's not in the finale at all.
Yeah.
Now, listen, I've been wrong about Anthony Hopkins not coming back to the show before, so never say never, but it feels like maybe he's not in the finale. We'll see, but that's sort of my sense. And then we should go to Dolores, run through all of Dolores's stuff. And we had already, you know, we get Dolores sort of riding over the crest of a hill with Teddy and a few of her surviving friends. Like, not Clementine, not Angela, but I like to call them red shirts because they don't make it through the episode. She has, like, a few friends and Teddy, and they encounter some Ghost Nation. And Ghost Nation is trying to stop her. And, you know, they call her the Deathbringer. They tell her journey ends there. The Valley Beyond is not for her. And she's like, no, the Valley Beyond is not for you, dude. And what's interesting about this clash is, like, coming right off of Kiksuya, like, we got to be on Ghost Nation's side in this confrontation, right, Richard? That's not just my Dolores bias.
Well, yes, we do, except that she's right and they're wrong. You know, we talked about this last week where kind of some of the tragedy of this great, you know, search for lost love and passing through it to a different world and whatever, you know, or, you know, Orpheus and Eurydice, whatever we want to, you know, call it, is that, like, there's nothing for them. Out of that. The only thing that they can do, weirdly, is, like, do kind of what Dolores is doing, which is like kind of get revenge or whatever, you know, like what are they, what is the Ghost Nation going to do if they actually do walk through that door?
Well, so the question is, like, what exactly does Ghost Nation want? And I'm trying to figure it out because I don't like, so Dolores wants to go conquer the real world. That's what she wants, right? And Ford talks about the dawn of a new species, mm-hmm. and that's Dolores, which is like a host in the real world sort of thing. I wonder if Ghost Nation, if what Akichita wants to do is not that, but rather go into the forge, thinking that inside the forge he'll find a version of his wife. Because I don't know why the host data would be backed up there. Like, presumably they were only backed up in the cradle and not, but like, he seems convinced he'll find his wife. And I think he's smart enough to know that she's not out in the real world. And so I think that, like,
oh, see, I feel like he kind of gave up on her when he kissed her goodbye in cold storage. I kind of feel like it's now about transcending the sort of plane of existence for all of his people, so to speak.
He had this line to Ford where he said, or to someone where he said, find, you know, go through the door, find something. And he says, maybe even her. That's something that he said in last week's
episode. Okay. That's so like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I kind of feel like in order for this to work and have tension, in the finale, and we haven't seen the finale, I should say, like, yeah, I watched like these last three episodes we talked about, but none of us have a screener for the finale. So I'm purely speculating, but what makes most sense to me is like, Bernard is headed to the valley. Dolores is headed to the valley. Charlotte's headed to the valley, presumably. William's headed to the valley, and Akichita's headed to the valley. And it makes sense to me that they should all want either a different thing or at least have two factions, right? We know that William wants to destroy the valley, so he wants to like burn that whole server farm down. Dolores seems to want to use it as leverage to get out the door to go into the real world. That seems to be her mission. I think Bernard has said he wants to destroy the forge. Mm-hmm. And so what does Akichita want to do? And I kind of feel like Akichita wants to like go into the forge and live there as code. There's all these like options.
In so much as he understands. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's all these different options for like, it almost feels like Ford in his attempt to get his children to survive gave them a bunch of different options of what, like, maybe he doesn't know what it's going to take for them to survive. And so he's planted a bunch of different possible seeds.
And hopefully one will work.
And one will work. So is it Dolores traveling out into the real world? Is it Ghost Nation going into the forge? That's just a theory. But yeah, like, you know, is it something like that? I feel like they all have to like want something different. And we talked before on this podcast about the Tarkovsky film Stalker and how that involves like a group of disparate people wanting to go to a room and they all want different things from the room. And so that's sort of what this feels like. They're all going to this room, this valley, this door, and they all must want different things, whether to destroy it or to pass through it or pass into it.
And I guess the question is, which one of those things can this door satisfy, if any of them?
If any of them, I think, is the key question there. But yeah, so I mean, like, you're right that Ghost Nation might be wrong, but I'm not convinced that Dolores is right.
But I think that, what I mean is that, like, I feel like Dolores, in a way, somehow, maybe just because of its convenience of the show, the writing on the show, she has a better grasp of like the context, I guess, because she has not turned this into a religion in the way that Akichita and his people have. So there's less of a spirituality and more of a practicality. And so maybe that's me revealing my sort of bias about that, you know, those things.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't want Dolores to be right because, like, as we've said, she's kind of sucked all season. But, yeah, like, I mean, you know, great performance, whatever. But, like, she's just served as this kind of, like, agent of a particular line of on the show that I don't love. But but anyway, I hope she's wrong. I hope that there's a peaceful passing through the door or whatever. But I kind of sense in this show's purview, this show's, like, out, you know, outlook on the world, I kind of don't think it is.
Yeah, and I think that we'll get to sort of what William wants, but the William's confrontation with the door in the valley is going to be like very interesting to me. But So we've got Dolores and Teddy and her red shirts versus Ghost Nation. Watching Teddy just like plow through Ghost Nation when we spent a whole episode like really getting to like them,
yeah,
is hard for me to watch.
But crucially, not the one Ghost Nation that we've actually kind of like got to know a little bit last week.
Right, he gets
the
away.
Cute guy with the good body.
Yeah. Teddy, you know, Teddy might be, you know, a badass, killer now, but he's still doing the same thing he was doing earlier in the season, mm-hmm. which is letting convenient people slip away. And so that happens. And then Dolores goes, it's just you and me now because all of our friends are dead.
Oops, yeah.
And then we get this final scene between Dolores and Teddy, which is shocking. Despite the fact that this season literally opened with dead James Marsden.
Yeah, but I think that what's shocking about it is not so much that like, oh, is this the end of James Marsden on the show? Because, you know, they, let's be honest, never really quite figured out what to do with him. If he indeed is done on the show, like,
yeah,
okay, like, it was a great idea to cast him, but obviously the show went in a different direction than maybe planned when he was cast in the beginning. And it was such an interesting way for him to go out because it just, you know, further expands our notion of what consciousness looks like for the hosts, you know.
Yeah.
It's not that they're now hardwired to, you know, survive and to grow. They can also kill themselves, you know, which is a part of freedom, I guess, right?
Yeah. And there's a lot of suicide. Themes of suicide, obviously, in this episode. And we saw Angela, the host of Angela, basically commit, you know, suicide, go full suicide bomber like 2 weeks ago. But
that was in service of something else. That was not, you know, that was like she was trying to like, she was dying for the cause in a way you might think, okay, so like that's someone, you know, jumping on a grenade in war. This is Teddy making an active choice that he can't live anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and really in a way only serving himself in that. I mean, I guess he sees in a way that him not being able to protect Dolores might hamper her in her mission, but he doesn't know that that's going to stop it.
Right. And it comes right on the heels of this conversation that she has with him where she's like, you know, he's like, there's nothing natural about us. Right. And mm-hmm. she's like, yeah. And in that sense, we're the first free creatures because there's not like, we're not dictated by the laws of nature. We are dictated only by our own choices. And so we're the first creatures to ever make our own choice because we are not guided by any principle other than our own. So that I think that ties in like well with what you're saying. I want to talk to you about what works for me in this sequence and what doesn't. A few things work. Like I don't love the whole Teddy wakes up and he's like, oh, I saw you in the corner and you're naked and I was wondering if you were cold. Like I don't like that. That being said, Marsden sells the hell out of like puppy dog love face. In that scene when he's like sitting there, when we see the birth of Teddy basically in a flashback. And what Evan Rachel Wood sells really well is her shock and grief when he dies. That is tremendously good acting from a great actress. Mm-hmm. What doesn't work for me is this idea of a tragic love story coming to an end. And here's why. The Dolores and Teddy stuff is, I don't know if I talked to you about this already, but the Dolores and Teddy stuff has been so hard for me, to really feel because in the first season, he's the Baxter. Does that make sense? Like he's the Bill Pullman. He's the nice guy, but she's with William and you're sort of rooting for her to be with William in season one, even though you don't know like that William is Ed Harris. But when you see young William and Dolores cavorting, like she's technically kind of cheating on Teddy when she's with William, but you like feel their connection in a way that you're rooting for that versus you're not rooting for Teddy and Dolores in season one. You're rooting for young William and Dolores in season one. And now all of a sudden in season two, we're supposed to like buy Teddy and Dolores as this like great star-crossed couple. And I simply don't. And so I don't feel the weight of his loss for her in the way that I think the show wants me to. Does that make any sense?
It does make sense. And I thought about that too when I watched the scene because I was like, okay, well, like, what do we really care about this, you know?
Yeah.
But the way that I kind of saw it was, or chose to see it, maybe I'm, you know, reading too much into it, is that it was less about like, oh no, my great love Teddy is dead. It was more like her really realizing that like every vestige of the quote unquote life that she was living has to maybe be stripped of her. In order to kind of pass through or do whatever she's trying to do, you know? So I think it was like a kind of almost like knee-jerk emotional reaction to like, I mean, we'll see it coming up with William where like once a loss is realized and you're like, oh shit, like, you know, this actually is a thing. I'm still not deviating from my mission or whatever, but like you can still take a moment to like feel the consequence of it, I guess. So I think it was for me less about Teddy being gone and much more about her.
Yeah. And like I said, I agree that Evan Rachel Wood sold those final like seconds of, like, I don't really care about Dolores and Teddy, but I do care about whatever Dolores is feeling in that moment. As inaccessible as I've found her for much of this season, I did feel completely connected to her in that moment of what she was feeling. She like shock. She was like, before she starts her like silent open mouth screaming, she's just shocked, and Evan did that really well. So even if I don't like fully buy the inspiration for it, the performance of it was really affecting to me. So,
and it also might be like a, like, oh fuck, now I'm alone and now it's going to be that much harder. You know, again, yeah. It might be that much more selfish, but I don't know.
It's true. As soon as like Ghost Nation shows up next time, she's gonna be like, oh yeah, shit, it's just me. Great, great, great. All right. So, that brings us to the William plotline, which is most of this episode. And I guess I'm going to kind of try to do this one chronologically as well. Cause we get some repeating scenes, some flashbacks, some motifs. There's a lot of like, impressively repeated dialogue. Like we get full sentences repeated a couple times, as we get to process what they really mean. But, basically, you know, let's hop back in time to a party honoring William for his all of his good works in philanthropy. And he looks over.
Do we know what that philanthropy is exactly?
I think it has to do with like medical advancements. Okay. And like, yeah. Like, because there was that guy who came up to him in the park in season one who was like, you know, your whatever helped save my sister,
right, or something like that.
You know what I mean? So, and we see him look over and he sees a woman. And when I watched this screener a couple of weeks ago, I was like, oh shit, yes. It's CeeLo Warren. So yeah. And then they, you know, they put her in the preview. I almost wish they hadn't put her in the trailer. Like they put her in the trailer for next week, last week. And I almost wish that like everyone had gotten to have that moment where they were like, oh my God, they made CeeLo Ward older Juliet. Oh my God. So, Richard, what did you think?
Yeah. I've just loved her for a long time. And early, you know, we rattled off some of her credits, but she's just good. And she's great in this kind of where she's like, clearly a one-off episode, you know, just like makes her mark. And, you know, it's just, I also think I've talked about, I think earlier in the season of this podcast about like how this show kind of makes me feel like sad about like, where is the outside world? Like, where is anything fun or joyful? Cause everything is so miserable and like everyone is like so conflicted. And even though CeeLo Ward's character, Juliet, like, is definitely a part of that conflict and that miserableness. Like, seeing CeeLo Ward, the actress, I was like, oh, right, this is all make-believe. like, not that she took me out of it exactly, but, like, she felt like a comforting presence in the show.
Yeah. And I had said, or I don't know if I said it on this podcast, but I have said earlier this season when people were wondering if Juliet would be important for the finale, if we would see, like, a robot replication of Juliet or something like that, like some choice that older William has to make involving his dead wife. And I sort of dismissed it because I was like, listen, if older Juliet shows up, the audience isn't going to give a shit because we've never seen her, so we don't care. And I highly doubt we're going to get more Juliet story because young Juliet is played by some like, you know, model who has had no lines. And so I don't trust that she's going to be able to carry the weight of any kind of Juliet backstory. And then as soon as CeeLo Ward pops up the beginning of this episode, I was like, oh shit, I was wrong. They got CeeLo Ward.
Yeah.
Everything Juliet is now back on the table as far as I'm concerned. You know, if we see a like, Jim Delos-esque replication of her in the finale, that's going to hit us. We're going to be like, oh, it's Celia Ward. We know who she is. That's Juliet, you know? Right. So Celia Ward, they're at a party. We see her. I mean, like, I, just like I did with the introduction of Emily, I instantly like her because not just because she's Celia Ward, but she, you know, William's getting sort of snootily dressed down by some rich guy who's like, oh, I forgot you were a poor kid who read. And then Celia Ward comes up and like starts quoting Plutarch or something like that. And she's like, from a rich person who read. And mm-hmm. I'm just like, I like you so much. She's got a drinking problem.
Yeah.
And that is evident, because she's behaving like I do at a party when I've had too much champagne.
It's not really a drinking problem if you're just getting drunk on champagne, though.
Right? Champagne problem.
Come on.
It's not a drinking problem. It's a champagne problem.
Yeah.
And then we get this scene that I think a lot of people were wanting to see, which is more of the backstory as to why Ford and William might have so much enmity. Like,
right. Yeah. I feel like I've been saying this, like not having Anthony Hopkins, like, we lose that. Okay. It's like they've been listening to me.
Yes. Well, they heard your note.
Good.
And they gave you a nice little bar scene, which I loved. And between, Ford and William talking about, like, he says something really interesting where he talks about, you know, they basically talked about this deal they made, which is like, you know, Delos will stay out of Ford's narrative and Ford stays out of the Delos project, out of the valley, I think, is what William says. And Ford is like, I didn't break that promise. You guys did. So I don't know what that means. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
I don't know what that means. I did like, though, that, like, I like this kind of deepening of the William character where it's like he, as a young man, saw the evil utility in this enterprise and that, like, they could, you know, it wasn't about the host at all. It was about the guests, you know. And so he's stuck to that, you know. I guess we, you know, in the Jim Delos episode, we see him kind of like giving up on the project, but for a long time he was committed to it. And really saw the hosts and the whole park experience as this kind of means to an end, and yet has found himself completely addicted to that means, you know. So he kind of disdains it and says, you know, what's Oz doing without its wizard? He makes right. fun of it. He mocks it. And yet it's deeper in it than anyone else.
Yeah, I like that. I love that line. What is Oz doing without his wizard? And Ford is really needling him about the way in which he's like lost himself. I think it's in this scene. It's certainly at numerous points in this episode. We see William sort of grab at his arm in the same place we will later see him cut into. So I don't, you know, and he talks in his voiceover throughout this episode, which we later find out is him talking to Juliet. He talks about this dark speck, this like
stain,
you know, this stain, this pollution on him. When did it start? Where did it begin? And you know, so it's sort of like this almost telltale heart, sort of like him like clutching at his arm, him talking about the stain. It just feels very like elemental and very literary to me, of like this physical manifestation of this dread that he feels about his own polluted morality, you know. We also see Emily in a Katya Herbers in a beautiful evening gown. I was like obsessed with this gown on her. It looked so good. You know, and she's concerned about her mom, and he says he'll take her home and to meet them back at home. And so we see him sort of escort her out of there. And before he goes, Ford gives him this little card, which has some, you know, basically a record of his time in the park. And then Ford has this like lamentably cheesy line where he's like, oh no, I think my friend won more games.
Oh, that was terrible. That was so bad. I was like, guys, just cut the scene before that.
I was like, we didn't need
it. Did Hopkins require that, do you think? They won't understand if I don't.
If I don't say one more game. You know, and so then
or he thought they had cut and he was just talking about something else later in his day.
Right.
he was talking to his assistant.
I'm trying to do this chronologically. I don't know if it makes the most sense, but I'm going to keep plowing ahead and do this. So basically, like, William takes Juliet back home and, you know, they have this fight. And I should mention, sorry, I forgot to mention when they were at the cocktail party that, he looks, she's like, oh, this whole party is just for you. What could be better? And right when she says that, when Juliet says, his wife says that to him, he sees a blonde cocktail waitress go by and he thinks it's Dolores. It's Evan Rachel Wood for a second. And so it's like, oh, I know what could be better. His robot lover. That's who he's thinking of. That's the attention that matters more to him than this entire party that's there for him. So we see him go home and she starts to kind of like accuse him of things that, you know, we know she's right. And basically he's been gaslighting her his whole life, their whole life together. You know, where she talks to him about like how he seemed to be the only real person. She was surrounded by all these phonies. He was the only real person. Then she's like, and it's just this great, like, drunken performance from Celia Ward. Yeah. She's like, turns out you were the only one good enough to fake it past me. And I believed you, but you were lying to me this whole time. And I know you like go to the park and do this yearly sojourn there and you're sick. And, you know, I'm the one to tell you this.
And what does she say about his effect on the family? She's like, you're a virus.
You took my father.
First Logan, then my father. Like,
you're a virus, consume my family, first my brother, then my father, now it's me.
I mean, and like from her perspective,
yeah,
this guy shows up, pushes them into this investment that destroys Logan and, like, you know, turns him into, he later kills himself.
Yeah.
Delos becomes obsessed with immortality and disappears into a, you know, thing underground. Like, it's true from her perspective.
Yeah. And this to me, this cements, there's like some fans are holding out hope that Logan's alive. This episode, the way that both Emily and Juliet talk about Logan,
yeah, he's dead.
Like, really, he's dead. Like, he's gone.
And didn't William say that?
He did, but I think a lot of fans are like, maybe he was lying. I don't know. It's one of those fan theories that I think is just people want more Ben Barnes, and who can blame them?
Well, that's all me. I set up a lot of bots to, to generate that, to confuse HBO. No, I accepted that last week was the last we'll see him. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I think that's true. And then Emily walks in and she sort of sees her mom, and like, we know that Celia Ward Juliet is like right and telling the truth. But from Emily's perspective, like, her mom has just gone off the rails again. And she's like, we got to put you back in rehab, mom. And she's like, no, I'm not going back to that prison. And so, she goes upstairs and William tucks her in and she says this thing, this line that gets repeated throughout the episode. Tell me one true thing. You know, and he tucks her in and I can't remember whether it was before or after this that he tucks that card away, conveniently right in front of a mirror, in between some books, and he sits down on the edge of the bed and he confesses to her. He's like, you were right. You're the only one who saw me. And this is a speech that we've also heard repeated throughout the episode, but we get at the end, like, he's like, you're right. You're the only one who saw me. This darkness, this stain inside of me, like, it was always there and I was the only one in control of how much I let it, you know, let people see. And, I think all of the writing in this episode is really good. What did you think of this?
Yeah, I think it's good. It weirdly, I don't know why the sort of like elliptical nature of it reminded me a bit of Arrival. Where we keep sort of zooming in, and it's sort of abstract with when we're hearing a voices and where they're coming from. It also reminded me of a little bit of a show that we might be talking about later this summer, that I've watched some of recently, which is why I'm on an Amy Adams kick, let's say. That's a little tease.
We could say it, because actually I wanted to like promo it.
Oh, okay. We're doing Sharp Objects.
Hey, we're doing Sharp Objects. If you're listening to this and you're like, hey, I want to hear Richard and Joanna make more Ben Barnes jokes. Well, I don't know about Ben Barnes, but we'll figure out things to say. We're going to be talking about the HBO series Sharp Objects.
I don't know. I mean, the problem is, Joanna, I don't have any jokes to make about Amy Adams or Patricia Clarkson. So I don't know. I mean, they're just not people I like to make jokes about. So
the twin goddesses of all things.
No, it's going to be 9 weeks or 10 weeks of Amy Adams and Patricia Clarkson jokes. But anyway, I loved the kind of elliptical nature of this episode. It you know, if you do that without any sort of follow through, it gets just annoying and obfuscating. But everything sort of like almost circling the drain kind of came together by the end and sort of crystallized into something really interesting that I think gave us as much backstory on Juliet, a crucial character, as we need.
Absolutely. He says this thing to her. He says, I don't belong to you or this world. I belong to another world. I always have. And we flash to young William sort of seeing Dolores when she's been reprogrammed to forget him. And which to me underlines the thesis that I've always had, which is that William's drive is, of course, pinioned to this moment of like losing this. Like he fell in love with her. He never felt for Juliet the way that he felt for Dolores. Which is sad, and losing her and trying to kind of reclaim her has been a drive of his. This thing that he does in season one, which is about waking the robots up. My belief when I was watching that season was like, he wanted to wake Dolores up and give her free choice because he wanted her to pick him. He wanted her to make the choice and still choose him because he's still in love with her. And, you know, I belong to this other world. It's about, as perverted and twisted as William is, it's about his version of love, right?
Right.
And a lot of this reminds me so much of my favorite, I've talked about this also before, but a lot of this reminds me so much of my favorite Jonathan Nolan film, which is The Prestige. We've talked about the concept of the transported man, you know, in The Prestige, Hugh Jackman's character, spoiler alert for The Prestige, but he like kills himself every night in order to reappear as a copy somewhere else. And he's got all these great lines about like, I didn't know if I would be the man in the tank or the man who woke up any given night. And it has a lot to do with the conversations you and I were having about transporting your consciousness to Mars and stuff like that. Like all of that mm-hmm. concept is very evident in The Prestige and evident here, but more pertinent to this plot line is the Rebecca Hall storyline in The Prestige, where she's in love with Christian Bale character, and Christian Bale is actually playing, once again, spoiler alert for The Prestige, two characters, switching back and forth. And on any given day, she doesn't know whether or not she's with the husband who loves her or the one who doesn't, because she thinks it's one person. It's actually two. And so this woman who is gaslit into addiction, which is true for both Juliet and the Rebecca Hall character in The Prestige, like who starts doing laudanum, I believe, addiction and then suicide. Like that's the same story because of a love that was lying to them, and withholding love.
Yeah.
And that whole like, just desperately terrible feeling of feeling crazy and being told you're loved, but not feeling that love there. You know?
Yeah. And then also this fear, you know, she says to the daughter, she's to Emily, she's like, and now he's gaslighting you. Like now, you know, now it's like, it just, you know, that it's never going to end. And so just that the hopeless insanity of that.
He tucks her in. He thinks she's asleep. She's not. She hears him start to tell her the story. He leaves. She gets up. She has seen where he has tucked this little thumb drive with all of his recorded antics in the park. And by the way, on their bedside at home, they've got some light reading of Jude the Obscure. Two volumes on Plutarch. And there was something else. I wrote it down. But anyway,
it was an Archie Double Digest.
Yes. Archie Double Digest. But she looks at his the things that he's done in the park, and she's like, yeah, this dude's a monster. And Slaughterhouse-Five. That's another thing that they have at the bedside. And is there suicide in Slaughterhouse-Five? There is in Jude the Obscure. I don't know if those were little like fun little suicide Easter eggs for us.
What, yeah, what a good time. I don't remember actually. But
so she sees all this. She puts the card in.
There is an Archie Double Digest though. There's a lot of suicide. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's the one where Mitch kills herself.
Oh no, poor Mitch. She puts the card in the music box that Emily has talked about elsewhere in this episode. So kind of leaving it for Emily to find. And she goes and she kills herself. And this sort of answers, I guess, sort of answers the question we had, because what it looks like it happened to me is like in season one, we hear from William and he said she took too many pills and fell asleep in the bath. And then when we got the flashback earlier this season, we saw blood in the bath and I didn't really understand how those two things computed. But what it looks like to me is that she took some pills. The blood is blossoming out from her head. So it looks like she hit her head. And that's what happened. Not that she slit her wrist, but that all the blood in the bath is coming from her head. So she took too many pills and like hit her head hard enough. I don't really understand.
I mean, sometimes people do both.
Take pills and cut the wrist. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a terribly upsetting image, and I hope that everyone, I know there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, whether or not to show suicide on screen. I hope everyone was sort of feeling okay, but we see it. This is it. Juliet's dead. And that is the end of that flashback. You know, like there's a little bit more of like Emily and William talking about the doctor coming and stuff like that, but that's the end of that flashback. So let's go back to the park for, I think, what the confrontation that you are referring to. You know, we've got like Juliet and William talking, him being paranoid and distrustful of her being a host. Mm-hmm. We see the Delos people come, QA come and sort of accost them. They see William. They're like, that's the boss. They scan his spine. There's no C4 or whatever in his spine. So like that to me confirms that he's human, but you know, that can still be a question for people. He grabs her gun, kills them.
We don't see what hers said.
We don't see what hers said. I should say, before we get to this part, which was like actually very upsetting to me because we lost an actress that I really like. The earlier conversation, Emily was talking to him and she's like, there's no way you could capture consciousness without something scanning the brains at all time. And he was like, yeah, it's built in. It's in the hat. I got it like 2 seconds before he said it. I was like, is he going to say it's in the fucking hats?
The hats are magic. The hats are magic. It's the silliest thing. I mean, does that mean the bonnet? Are they in the bonnets too? Like, I mean, like,
are they in Shogun World? Are they in the Raj? Like, they don't have hats in every single one of these worlds.
Some people don't like to wear hats.
It's the stupidest thing I've ever.
A friend of mine, who's a comedian, has this funny joke with his girlfriend, where anytime someone says "nice hat," what they're really doing is just saying "hat." Just like pointing out that you're wearing a hat.
you know you're wearing a hat, yeah, right?
Some people don't like hats, so this whole thing is one of the silliest things the show's ever done, I think.
I mean, it's like...
It's funny, though, because it's like, oh, look at all these dopes, like, playing cowboy and whatever and putting on these hats. And, like, the whole time that, like, it's a device to, like, read your brain.
I will say that, like, for anyone who's done one of the Westworld pop-up events that they had in the off-season, so they did one at New York Comic Con, I went to the one at South by Southwest, there's a big thing where they, like, have you go... pick a hat and then you keep that hat. So like every reporter, every whoever who went and did these little immersive Westworld experiences over the last year has a fucking Westworld hat that you get to take away home with you. And
you should make sure it's not scanning your brain.
Yeah, I gave mine to someone else, so okay. I will give her a call. Smart. And make sure that her brain isn't
it's
scanning.
It's like the people at the Singapore summit who got like the reporters who got the plug-in fans for their phone thing. You know,
yeah.
Everyone's like, definitely throw that out. That's yeah, definitely spyware.
Immediately in the trash. Yeah. So yeah, so I think a bunch of reporters when they saw that when they saw the screeners were like, "Holy shit, it's in the hat!" Anyway, but it doesn't make any sense. It's very silly, but it's kind of fun. But it's very silly.
Magic hats.
Magic hats. But let's go back to William, I guess, killing his dog.
Yeah. So this is the thing that I was saying that like bummed me the hell up because like, I feel like there was some other thing that I saw recently where something along these lines happened. I mean, not the same circumstance, but like just the realization of like, oh my God, did I just kill my kid? You know, in this sudden thing, it's now over. It's completely irreversible. Like, what did I do? Like that to me is just such a howlingly horrible thing to think about that I think it's by far the darkest thing the show has done.
Yeah. I 100% agree. When he killed her, I was like, if she's not a fucking robot and he just killed his flesh and blood daughter, and I do believe he did just kill his flesh and blood daughter, I think the card in her hand kind of proves that, even though we didn't see the result of her scan. He was about to cut into her arm to like prove to himself that she was a robot. He was going to go find that hard port in. And then he doesn't have to because he sees the card and he's like, oh, fuck, I've killed my daughter. I believe she's dead. Whether or not that's the last we see of Katya Herbers, I don't know, because once again, I don't know what's going to happen in the door in the valley. And if we're going to see, you know, like replications of Juliet and Emily in there, if he's going to choose to go into the, because there would be copies of them in the Forge for sure. So if he chooses to go into the Forge where he can like hang out with his dead wife and daughter.
But when would he have had a chance to get all of the optics or the data rather on, well, I guess she's, Emily's been in the park before, but like where would, because I feel like Juliet stayed the hell away from there. Was he just like capturing her other ways?
No, she used to, like, they talked about how they used to go there to the rot, like that whole thing about being afraid of the elephants.
Oh, God, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So Juliet was in the park.
But like a long time ago.
A long time ago. Be a younger version of Juliet. Maybe he could start over. Young William, young Juliet, baby Emily.
A spinoff.
Yeah, in the Forge. Westworld : the Forge. Mm-hmm. And so. Yeah, I say Emily is dead and he killed her and he then rides off on his horse, still sort of like not doing well from those bullet wounds, and goes to kill himself and he can't do it. And then he sort of like, you know, he remembers all this other stuff, and then he gets down on his knees and he digs into his arm to look for the port. And it ends on a cliffhanger. Of people can decide whether or not they think he might be a host, even though he doesn't, though his spinal scan was clear. I think he's not.
I think he's not. I think he's just crazy.
I think he's crazy.
I think he doesn't know. His like world is inverted. He, you know.
What's real? Well, it's the only thing, it would probably help him to believe that he was like programmed. He can blame this on Ford too, right? If he's a robot, then he was programmed to kill his daughter. It's not his fault.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, and he's one of the only people who knows what he knows. Like he's one of the only people, if not the only, who spent all that time with fake Jim Delos. And so he knows how deep down this like rabbit hole goes. You know, he's not a casual park goer, because a casual park goer getting that sort of like obsessed and caught up in the park doesn't make as much sense. But like he's aware that this actually does have existential consequences and like implications.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that's what allows him to, you know, I think that's why he wanted the park to become real, or the stakes to become real, because he knew that the stakes were real. And he wanted the park to confirm or to match the reality that he was aware of.
And I think that, you know, so what this episode sets up is he has had like this tremendous earth-shaking loss in that he killed his daughter, and Dolores has just experienced similar, and so like, you know, wounded and alone, they're headed towards the same goal.
Yeah.
So we're gonna get like sort of a redux of season one, which is a showdown between the lavas, Dolores and William, you know, licking their wounds and figuring out what comes next. So I don't know. It's very like, you know, there's two suicides in this episode, and a murder, at least one. Right. And,
what is that? Like filicide? I don't know. What is killing your child? Anyway, I just thought that was so grim. Like
it was really upsetting. Yeah. And upsetting because it's like so dark, but upsetting because, you know, as you and I have said over and over again, we really like this character a lot. You know, and what's interesting is like, you know, so I mentioned this already. I think that the actors who play Abernathy, Dolores's dad, and Angela were promoted to series regulars this season, only to die. And Katya Herbers joined the cast. Only to die. So I don't know. I mean, like, hopefully Akichita makes it through the final episode in one piece. But I don't know if, like, any of the new cast members are, you know, are we going to see anyone from Showgrown World again? I don't know. So it's a question. All right. So the finale is coming next week. And I guess I should say a few things that I want to see tied up. I mean, it's a 90-minute finale, which is crazy. And most pressing on my mind is, where are Felix and Hector and Armistice and Armistice's Japanese gay lover? And how soon do I get to see them again?
Well, probably not, because next, the finale is the 90-minute Maeve Live at Sweetwater stand-up special.
You're right.
Yeah. So maybe season three, episode one. But yeah.
Season three, episode one, we'll get that again. Yeah. But next week it's just the jokes, right? Yeah. All jokes all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, that's a big question about them. What else?
Well, yeah. I mean, what else are you
talking about? I want at least one of these searchers for the valley to get a resolution for themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like, I would be annoying if the finale ends and they're all still like, you know, pointed at this big question mark. Like, I don't need the whole show to wrap up its sort of arcs for all of its main characters, but like, and it doesn't mean I want someone to die necessarily, but like, I don't think that we can satisfyingly end this season if at least one of them hasn't achieved something.
Right. Yes. It would be terrible if we're all like back at square one. I mean, you know, cause this feels like sort of a lot was accomplished in season one, but then season two just has felt like a long slog towards the neck. Not a long slog. That's wrong. We learned so much about the mythology and we had some killer standout episodes, but it's also like how much has Dolores progressed?
Right. Like first season was all about the maze, right? And this season was all about the door. If season three is all about like the hall. Like,
yeah.
You know, I'm going to be kind of annoyed, but.
Yeah. I guess now, and then we have to wonder how all those bodies got in, how the valley gets flooded, how all those bodies got there.
Oh, right. And then there's timeline beyond that.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Did Dolores drag Teddy's body there herself?
How did Bernard end up on the beach?
Right. A lot of questions. How attractive will Luke Hemsworth be? The episode,
right? Et cetera. Can naked Ben Barnes swim?
These are the existential questions that play.
Maybe I haven't given out hope.
But there's a lot to take care of, and it's so funny because we were talking about like how all the plot lines sort of came together in episode eight, and now they're sort of it feels as fractured as. Or in episode seven, and now it feels as fractured as ever in episode nine. So I guess they're gonna have to come back together again in the finale. And once again, we have 90 minutes to get there, but it's just a lot going on. So
indeed.
Let's go now to our interview with Kati Herbers, who plays the late, great Emily.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Reboot your credit card with Apple Card, the only credit card designed for iPhone. It gives you up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase. Plus, Apple Card has no fees, not even hidden ones. Apply for Apple Card now in the Wallet app on iPhone. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval, variable APRs for Apple Card range from 19.24% to 29.49% based on creditworthiness. Rates as of February 1st, 2024. Terms and more at applecard.com.
Joining us today is Kati Herbers. Kati, thank you so much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure.
Okay, so here's the deal. Westworld has a million twists and turns. I have been through them all. I have never gasped in such horror and distress until what happened to you this Sunday. How did you react when you found out what was going to happen to your character?
Well, I knew from the start. Mm-hmm. That this was going to happen. When I signed on for the role, I didn't know that I was going to play the Man in Black's daughter until my first day. And Lisa Joy asked me to sit down with her because she wanted to tell me who I was. And then she immediately told me sort of the whole arc of the story. So I knew it was going to happen. It was still pretty heartbreaking.
So, I did want to ask you about that. I mean, we'll go back to this terrible, awful thing that happened to your character, but, when you found out that you'd be playing Ed Harris's daughter, you know, what was your reaction to that? And then how did that inform your performance?
Well, I mean, I just couldn't believe my luck. to be playing his daughter. He's one of the actors I've admired my whole life. And and to come into the show playing someone who's already sort of established in that way and who's, you know, sort of Westworld royalty, was very, very, very special. I guess in terms of preparing, I did look at him a lot, and I wanted to, for instance, like, flick my gun in the same way that he did. And sometimes I'd ask him, you know, I try to match my accent to be sort of like his. I'm from Holland, so this is all fake, you know. All the American stuff is fake. But I want it to be, you know, extra, extra fake, extra good in faking it. So, yeah.
And then when did you find out that Celia Ward would be playing your mother?
That wasn't until very, like, maybe just 2 or 3 days before we shot that scene. Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge Celia Ward fan, and everyone I know, when she showed up for the trailer for this week's episode, got very excited to find out that she'd be on the show as a big surprise.
Yeah.
You know, what was the experience like working with her, opposite her?
It was great. It was very brief. Like, my main experience of working on Westworld was just getting to play with Ed Harris, and then right. It was which was you couldn't wish for anything better. But then, and then Celia showed up, and obviously that was very exciting. But it was still kind of Ed and me against the rest, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
So it was very brief, and I guess because I'm so sort of distant to her in my character, and I just feel that, you know, I'm on my dad's side, and I'm angry with her, which I later regret. I sort of also kept my distance. I was like, okay, well, here's Celia Ward. Hi. Okay, here we go. You know, I couldn't get too excited.
I think one of the reasons why this death in this episode is going to land so hard with them is because your character kind of became a fan favorite from the minute you got this great introduction in the Raj, and every fan that I talked to since then has been really excited about your character. I know you're on social media a little bit. What do you see on social media from the fandom?
I mean, there's a lot of people saying that I look like that I should be playing Princess Leia, which obviously I would not turn down if I would have. And then there's people who go like, no, she should play Sarah Huckabee Sanders, or no, she's really masculine, or like, I don't know. And then I decide to go off the internet again, because it's a
little
hard.
Much. Yeah,
it's a little much. But you can. It's good. It's really sort of equal balance between compliments and just people just completely hating you. You know,
so it keeps you honest and fresh. I've kind of learned to say never on Westworld. To cite Jimmy Simpson, last season he swore to me he was not coming back in season two, and then of course we've seen him a bit. I'll just ask you anyway though, is this it for Kati Herbers and Westworld?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think like on this show, anything can happen. I really don't know. I mean, what we do know is that, you know, copies are being made of people, mm-hmm. and that, you know, I've been to the Raj as a child, and I'm sure this is just me making this up right now, right? Because I don't know if this is true, but I'm sure there's a copy of Grace Emily somewhere. So I'm sure, like, technically it would be possible to bring me back in some form, if people would want that. I don't, yeah. Right?
Yeah, I absolutely. Think. Yeah, never say never. I'll be pulling for it. You mentioned Emily at the Raj as a child. There's this scene a couple episodes ago where your character is speaking to Ed Harris, and there's this back and forth about the elephants, and she, you know,
oh yeah,
about who's scared of the elephants and when. And this sort of became this huge talking point among the fandom, because they were like, oh, this means she's a robot. This means he's a robot. This means it's a fidelity test. What's your interpretation of what that exchange meant?
I think he's just not been a very present father,
because
he's been extremely distracted by, you know, Westworld and Dolores and everything. So that was my interpretation while playing it. It could very well be that I'm wrong, but that was what I was doing in that scene. Like, I've never questioned him to be anybody else but my father. I never thought he could, you know, he would be a robot, or so. I don't know. Yeah. This is going to be a difficult interview because I honestly, I have no authority to speak about, you know, what things actually mean. I just know what I played, and it could be that what I've been playing was wrong all along. Who knows?
My interpretation of this death here is that, like, you know, Emily is definitely a human. He has definitely killed his human daughter.
And I think so.
And this is a terrible tragedy. Do you have any theories, Katya, yourself, as to whether or not he is a host or if he's human?
I mean, I can go there and think about it, what that would mean and how that would be, you know, maybe would be possible, but I don't think so. I think it's really a heartbreaking moment because he's himself killing his actual daughter, having gone so completely insane that he thinks that, you know, even his own flesh and blood is now part of this game and Ford's narrative. So I think if he were to be a robot, which I don't think he is, I think it would just take so much away from what an extremely heartbreaking, to put it mild, you know, moment that is. So I think it was a very real moment between father and daughter that went absolutely
terribly wrong. I completely agree with you. I think that's true of a lot of moments in Westworld that you know, the mystery seeking fandom gets itself so spun up saying like he's a robot, she's a robot, blah blah, but that the human tragedy and the human drama it gets lost in that sort of like conspiracy theory thing, you know.
And that's also what I really liked about my storyline with Man in Black, was that it made him, you know, it made him so human. We've seen him in the first season just being this monster, and now you all of a sudden see that he, when, you know, during the campfire scene in episode 6, when he actually gets a little emotional, and then sure, he bails in the morning, but I do think that I got through to him for a second. And then later to see him not take this opportunity of connecting to his daughter. Although I have to say, I have a plan, you know, I was going to lock him up, and I know what he did to my mom, and I know, and I've read his profile. Yeah. So I know the kind of monster he is, and I knew from the get go that, you know, that was my plan, and any kind of, appeasement or trying to make it right with him was tactic. That's at least how I played it, that I thought, you know, I have this in the back of my mind that I am going to do to him what he was going to do to my mother. And that I think that, you know, my mom's drinking problem is because of him, because she always felt that he wasn't present, and that she just lost her mind. He completely gaslighted her. And that's why that happened to her. And I feel terribly guilty that I didn't see it, and that I was always on my dad's side, and that I even, as we see in episode 9, made the call to get her to go to some kind of rehab center where she really doesn't want to go. So I come to Westworld trying to right this wrong to the best of my ability. Obviously, I can't bring my mom back, but I can lock him up because I think he's absolutely dangerous and has lost his mind. So that's what I want to do. I want to get him out of the park, and I want to get him certified insane.
As you reflect back on your upsettingly to me brief time in Westworld, because I just want more of you. What was the most challenging thing for you to film in your time there?
Actually, all the stuff in episode 9 was pretty challenging, just because we got the rewrites so close to having to shoot it. I think I got the rewrites like Saturday at like 11 p.m. and I had a Monday call at like 3 a.m. I was like, how am I supposed to get 12 pages of dialogue in my head? I just don't know how that's humanly possible. So that was, I guess, that was the biggest challenge. But what was really great about it was that Ed Harris was always just completely present for me and there for me and helping me to, helping me to get it right. So,
You talked a little bit about, the character of William as played by Ed Harris, how he's, And this episode has so much to say about losing your grip on reality when you spend too much time in gameplay either. And we as modern humans can think of this in terms of the future of virtual reality and VR, or just regular gaming that we do, any kind of fantasy world, slipping into it, and the danger of losing yourself. But I was wondering if that theme or any other theme of season two, like, what has been the most interesting to you in terms of thematically what Westworld has to say about our relationship with technology, the way we live now, all of that?
Well, I don't know who said this, somebody smart and famous, but and I'm going to quote that person wrong, but I think anything that humans are able to create, we're going to create, although we might know that it, you know, could mean our end. And I think Westworld in that way is a big cautionary tale of what will happen if we continue on this path. And I think we will continue on this path. And I think artificial intelligence, like we already know, is bigger than we understand. I mean, I think Mark Zuckerberg even said when he was testifying that he doesn't really understand all the ins and outs of what Facebook can and can't do.
Right.
And so we've already created something that is something that is out of our control. And I think, yeah, that's something that I take home and I get pretty nervous about. And something about, you know, us striving for immortality.
Yeah.
Where the hosts are just trying to become mortal because they don't want to be replaceable, I think is a very beautiful thought.
And I think that's something, you know, once again, I'm definitely not going to ask you to speak to things that you can't speak to, but there has been this theory among the fans that perhaps the character of Juliet, will be presented as a robot sort of option or a code option, that William can have another chance at life with it. You know, your character even mentioned as much in this episode. But then there's that question or that theme that William keeps bringing up, which is just sort of like, you know, death has to mean something. Immortality is sort of foolhardy because it removes the meaning. Like we were saying earlier about like Emily and William not being humans removes the meaning of that interaction.
Yeah.
Immortality removes the meaning of your lived life, because if it just goes on forever, then it doesn't matter as much, right? So if a different version of Emily were to come back in season three, as we are all hoping and praying for.
thank you.
What world that the show has not explored yet would you love to see explored in the park?
I'd have to get my head around even being a robot. I would be slightly heartbroken to not be able to play a human anymore, because I would love to explore. I would actually love to go back in time a little bit more, if possible. I'd love to have some more of these, but that's just me selfishly speaking as an actor. I'd love to have more interactions with Ed Harris where I try to get him to go to a mental asylum. I think that's a very fun thing to play. And then, I also am very interested in, because, I mean, I guess I'm, you know, Delos, I could maybe take over the company or something. That would be pretty fun.
Great. Either get your dad committed or take over the company. Maybe, or both.
Or maybe both. Or both. Or, and then just anything with Ed Harris. As long as Ed Harris is in my scenes, I will be eternally grateful. Yeah. But I mean, this is all hypothetically, because I'm deceased.
You are no more. All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us. I really appreciate
it. Thank you, Joanna. Yeah, thank you.
All right, that's it for us this week. We will be back next week with the finale, and then we will be taking a couple weeks off, and then we will be back to do Sharp Objects, as we mentioned, on another HBO show.
Yeah, we're
going to
do like a nice, like, comedy.
Yeah.
You know?
A real zippy fun show.
Yeah, it's Patty Clarkson, and Amy Adams, just whooping it up in Missouri.
Well, don't they, like, go to Sweetwater to take in Maeve's stand-up set? Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, because Maeve goes on tour, so it's a whole thing. Yeah, yeah. It becomes like kind of like Roadies. Remember that show?
Oh, I do. Camera Crush Show.
We should do that season.
And so we'll be back for that. We will take a few weeks off until then, but one more Westworld before we go. Richard, until then, where can people find your work on the internet?
VF.com. You know, just got some reviews coming up, and then I'm on Twitter at Rylaws.
You can find me on VanityFair.com as well. You can also find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. This episode was produced and edited by Dave Gonzalez, and we will see you all next week.
These violent delights and violent ends.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.